I'm having more.
Get the knives out. Dish is about to be served. Outrageous. Are you kidding? I've been inside only one woman after I was born. The Statue of Liberty. Provocative. If it's a pain in the ass, honey, you're not doing it right. Pop culture. Meanwhile, she's on the cover of Us Weekly, dating. Boyfriends are like jobs, except he probably stopped sucking after a year. Wicked. What do I look for in a guy? My dick. Smart. Sexy. Contemporary. I mean, I can't. Porn Again, the podcast.
Hi, everyone. I'm Josh Sabara. Thanks for joining us again. I'm very excited about my guest today, who is multi-hyphenate Fenton Bailey, the brilliant and creative mind behind such groundbreaking series as RuPaul's Drag Race and Million Dollar Listing, as well as documentaries including The Eyes of Tammy Faye, Party Monster, and Inside Deep Throat. Fenton is going to tell us about the acclaimed new documentary that he produced and directed with business partner Randy Barbato called Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, which is airing and available now on HBO, And so we're going to talk about the film and the filmmaking process. And I may sneak in a few questions about RuPaul's Drag Con, which is coming up May 7th and 8th at the LA Convention Center. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Fenton.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you. So before we get into all of the things that you have going on, I typically need to take a couple of minutes just to discuss things that are irritating me that week.
Oh, gosh. Two minutes?
I know. Well, I know. Sometimes I could fill the hour with that. But I wanted to get your opinion on... Okay, so there, you know, Susan Sarandon is very political. Everybody's very political right now.
She is, yeah.
And, you know, I wish she'd stick to acting because we haven't seen anything like a Thelma and Louise for a long time. So maybe she should refocus. But I don't really care about, like, I'm not even getting into politics. That's not what this show is about. I'm not interested in who anybody's voting for. But did you see that she and Deborah Messing got into a Twitter war?
I did, you know, and I tell you the truth, I didn't follow the back and forth of it. I just thought,
why? Because you're an adult who doesn't need to be. I mean, that's sort of the point.
There was a really great Jacob Bernstein, who's a friend, wrote a fantastic article in the New York Times about celebrities taking their sides in the upcoming election. Mm-hmm. And he said one thing that I thought was just sort of said it all. It was like Bernie Sanders, you know, he's anti-millionaires and billionaires and all that. And yet, at a rally, he had a VIP area roped off. And of course, guess who was in it? Susan Sarandon.
Right, of course.
And I just thought that, well, there you are. That's, you know, bring on the revolution, but keep the VIP area, whatever.
Exactly.
You do,
always have right? velvet rope.
Yes.
And then, of course, you have Deborah Messing jumping in the mix.
Right.
And then they bring in... Okay, this is my favorite part. It's like, if it could possibly get more irrelevant, okay? Then they rope in Kathy Najimy, okay?
Right.
The fat nun from Sister Act in the 80s.
And didn't Rosie O'Donnell come into it?
Then we have Rosie O'Donnell. I'm like, Rosie, your kids are running away. You can't keep a wife. Maybe there's other things to be concerned about than a Twitter war.
Right. Well, I guess it's good that celebrities are beating each other up on Twitter rather than... real life.
They'll do each other in and we'll all be fine.
It's kind of fun to watch, right? I guess,
but I'm like, these are grown adult women having a war on social media.
It's also supremely pointless, right? Whose mind has changed? How will the outcome of the election
not
be
at
affected?
All. And then we've got somebody like Rosario Dawson. Remember her back when she was Rosario Dawson?
Yeah.
I mean, and she's like getting all of this press for supporting Bernie Sanders. And I'm like, who? Who? I didn't really even know who you were when you were who you were.
I love that. Have you seen that ad, Feel the Burn?
Yes.
Forget an STD check? I mean... Nothing is sacred.
No, which is good.
Yeah.
I'm good with that.
I like that.
Okay, so that's my
That's the only thing that's irritating. This
well, there's a lot oh. more, but you have too much going on for me to spend too much time on me.
Oh, come on.
I'm choking on the truth. As much as I like to talk about myself. Okay, so you and your business partner, Randy, founded... World of Wonder in 1991. Is
yes.
that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you had been friends before that and had gone to school together. Is that right?
We met at film school in 1900. And
you don't have to peg the year.
We were together pretty quickly in every sense. We were boyfriends for a long time.
So how did that... So tell me a little bit about the trajectory of your relationship and how you sort of merged from one... From schoolmates to lovers to business partners, and you've been successful as a partnership in so many different ways. So tell me about that.
Well, it sort of happened. We met at film school, and it was pretty quick. And we decided we wanted to work together as well. And so we shot each other's films. That's the way film school worked. But we quickly dropped out of film school because neither of us could afford it. So Randy got a job on Madison Avenue, and eventually I got a job on Wall Street editing videos. And that was by day. And then by night, Randy and I had this kind of crazy idea that if we became pop stars, we could fund our filmmaking career because we wanted to make movies.
But that's such an obvious thing, become a pop star.
Well, it seemed obvious to us.
I mean, I've thought about it many times.
We overlooked the need to have a record contract and record, well, not a contract, but hits.
Right.
We got a record contract, but we didn't have hits.
Yeah, that one little thing.
That small detail. So we never did get to fund our movies. And anyway, perhaps, you know, who knows, the way it works in pop, if you have a hit, doesn't necessarily mean you make any money anyway.
That's true.
The record company takes it all.
That's absolutely true.
So relieved.
You'd have to have publishing.
Relieved
you'd
have to have written burden. The songs. Yes, exactly. Well, we did write the songs. But relieved of that burden, we were always fixated by Manhattan Cable, the public access channels in New York. And they were these crazy shows.
Like Robin Bird.
Robin Bird, of course. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites was Voyeurvision. Mm-hmm. Lynn, who lay on a bed and you call in right. and tell her to do things.
Right.
And she was just very...
She was ahead of her time because now we have cam shows.
She was.
Right.
She really was ahead. Right. It was like Videodrome.
Right.
And there were also things like Mrs. Mouth and Life with Jim. I mean, just amazingly creative, very punk shows. I mean, these were like shows made on a shoestring.
Right.
And anybody could make them. And we were inspired by that. And we were actually in London recording our album because we finally got signed to a record contract. And there was nothing to watch on TV and we were miserable. And that's when we had the idea, oh, wow, why don't we clip these shows together, you know, make clip shows of all the crazy Manhattan Cable stuff and make it as a British TV show. And we did. And it was a hit. It was a huge hit.
So what happened to the album?
You know, sad story. We were dropped the day they released our first single. London Records dropped us. So, and it was a cover version of Desiderata.
You're a Child of the Universe.
It certainly does.
Okay,
yes,
I'd like to have a copy.
I think there's even a video on YouTube. So, you know.
I'll be looking at that up later. So unaware of that. Okay, so that was sort of the start of it all.
It was, yes.
And then how did it evolve into World of Wonder?
Well, that was our first production. Manhattan Cable was our first. We had World of Wonder Records that put out Pop-Tart Records.
Okay.
And then World of Wonder Productions when we got our first show with Channel 4 UK. And so once we had one show and we'd moved into this loft that was also an office and we had to pay the rent, so we needed another show. And that's how it went from one thing
to the
other.
That's so fascinating. So what was did you have like a mission statement for the company? Did you have that we are going to make a certain, I mean, obviously you're known now for doing things that are a little counterculture. Did you know that that was going to be your brand?
Well, yes, I suppose we did subconsciously because Manhattan Cable itself, you know, was very counterculture. It was very punk. And especially in the context of British television, which was not the sort of wild thing American television is. It was anarchy. It was anarchy on the TV. A very controversial in a good way. And I suppose the mission statement is in the name of the company, World of Wonder, because it is. It is a world of wonder.
And by the way, right? People can sort of learn more about the company and that you have an amazing coffee table book called The World According to Wonder, which I think people can get on Amazon. Is that right?
They certainly can, yes.
And it sort of goes through the whole history of and how the company sort of changed and became and all of that with some great photos, by the way.
Yeah, Tony and Idris took the pictures and Matthew Anderson too. And it's like this big coffee table book, weighs 8 pounds, but it also does have words in it No one reads coffee table books, you know.
I do. No. I have a huge collection of coffee table books.
That you read in bed at night.
I do. I totally read coffee table books. I know that's weird, but I also read Playboy for the articles, and you know that's true.
No.
So you sort of discovered RuPaul in a way, or if not discovered, I know he was on the scene in New York, but right. brought him into a more national spotlight. Is that right?
Well, you know, our paths crossed, and because there's no discovering RuPaul. I mean, I tell you who discovered RuPaul was RuPaul. No question. The very first time we saw him, he knew he was a star. And that's exactly what Randy and I said to each other. We're like, oh my God, this person is a star. And so it was really just a question of waiting for the rest of the world to catch up.
But you gave him a platform.
Well, we got him a record contract. That's like, he came to us and said, I don't know why, because like, it wasn't as if the Pop-Tarts pop career had been a massive success, right. but for some reason...
but you were seen as the go-to people.
He came to us right. and said, will you manage me? And we're like, okay. I mean, we really totally believed in him. And in fact, the very first time we saw him, he was supposed to introduce our show. We were performing in Atlanta. And we, Randy and I were like, oh my gosh, this guy belongs on stage, not us, you know? And... So we got him his record contract. He had a demo, Supermodel. They did record it with Larry T and Larry Kupfer, I believe. Is that right? Yeah. And Jimmy Harry wrote it as well. And we went to every record label and they were like, no, 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 no. And Tommy Boy Records, which was a hip-hop label, I said yes. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was the weirdest thing. But Monica Lynch that loved Rue and got the whole thing. And from there, Supermodel was a hit. And... was the most spectacular launch. It was just amazing, really.
Did you feel like you were, because it was something that wasn't in the public's consciousness as much in terms of drag and sexuality in general, did you feel like you were taking a gamble at all?
No. No, I mean, it was just blind faith that Rue just had this, radiated this star quality. And so it didn't really... The wig and the heels, it wasn't about that. It was about a spectacular presentation and just a lovely, also an amazingly warm feeling that came from him, you know. There was no question in our minds. So you could say it was a risk, but it didn't seem like one.
Did you, with the success of RuPaul's Drag Race now, do you think it signals sort of a shift in people's attitudes about sexuality and gender? Do you think the sort of national acceptance or international acceptance of that because the shows do well outside of the U.S. as well?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny, isn't it? Because every time I think, oh, well, this battle is over. We're here, we're queer, we're loved, we're accepted. Something extraordinary happens, like the North Carolina,
right.
And it's like, you know, Jesse Helms in the 90s mm-hmm. denounced Mapplethorpe and tore up his pictures on the floor of the Senate. And
right.
Jesse Helms is long gone. And the moment, and you think, oh, he's gone. But then his old state enacts this ridiculous law. So it's a weird thing of two steps forward and then a step back, I guess. But I guess overall, there's forward momentum. I mean, we can get married.
Right.
We can have kids.
Right.
You know.
Right. As they say, we can be as miserable as everyone else.
Yeah,
so,
I know, right.
RuPaul's Drag Con, how did that come about?
Well, you know, it was the logical step. I mean, the great thing about...
Well, not for everybody. I mean, this is the same, you know, obviously you've sort of come up with ideas at every turn and made them successful.
So. Well, it was just like, you know, I guess, I think it was, we were trying to, Randy and I were trying to remember, but I think it was one thing was people watch Drag Race as a family mm-hmm. or en masse, you
right.
know,
sort of a community
in a bar.
Thing.
It's
yes.
a community thing. It's a feel good mm-hmm. thing. And so it was like, how can we extend that experience? And I also think, you know, as everything gets so digital and virtual and social media, and so as we have less and less actual contact with each other, so real contact becomes an amazing thing to have. And I think that's why a lot of these cons do so well, because your tribe can get together and really be in the same room together and have this experience. And it really is a really feel-good It's like a fun fair. It's like
it was amazing last year.
It's going to be good this year too.
It's a great time. Well, it's going to be better this year because I'm going to be signing copies of porn again there.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean,
I'm so glad you're coming.
How much better does it get
that.
Than that?
You're looking forward to it.
I'm excited. Yeah. Do you think
what are you going to wear?
You know, well, actually, I had to do a photo shoot for something else, and I may have sneaked in a few almost drag photos to promote it. So. You might be surprised. People will have to show up, buy tickets. Where can people buy tickets?
Online.
But thanks for being as good at self-promotion as I am. I think it's www.rupaulsdragcon.com.
Thank you. Yes.
Where can you buy
Google
tickets?
That.
Let's narrow that down for you. Online. But here's what I want to know is, now, being in the business of making movies and making television series, do you think that brands nowadays have to do more than just live on the screen? Like, DragCon is sort of a move in that direction of taking the experience off of people's television screen, where it is even if people watch as a community, watching it on TV or watching a movie is a passive experience to a large degree. So do you think that everybody in the industry is going to have to up his or her game a little bit and branch out into this kind of more tactile experience?
Yeah, I think...
And you're just at the forefront of it?
I don't think everybody has to do it, but I think it's really exciting the way all those traditional barriers are breaking down so that now you can do, back in the day, you were an artist and you'd paint pictures, or you were a photographer, or you were a fashion designer, or all these things had very distinct, they were distinct professions. And I feel now that if you're an artist and a creator, you can do any of them. And the sequence in which you do them is almost like your unique DNA, creative DNA.
Right.
And I think that's just wildly exciting. I don't think you have to do that. I mean,
it seems like that you have to be able to reach people in different and more creative ways now. It's not as easy as it used to be to just get people to... You can get them there at first, but to keep them in the tent is a little more difficult nowadays.
And you know this. I mean, you know this as an artist. You have a responsibility to reach your audience. It's not enough. And I don't think it ever was, by the way, enough just to sit in a tower, create your beautiful work, and sit back and wait to be discovered. I don't think that was even true hundreds of years ago in the Renaissance. You had to go out and hustle. You know, you needed the Pope's patronage or the Medici's or whoever it was. And nothing's really changed in that respect. I think you have to, if you have something you want to create and want to communicate, you also have to reach out and grab that audience any way you can. And I think that's part of the gig.
And
I
keeping think them.
Yes.
Keeping them.
Totally.
Know?
So. It's exciting. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes a film director will say, I just want to direct films. And that's fine. But but I'm not sure that that's... I think today you really have to do it all.
Yeah, you kind of have to be a business. You know, the commerce and the art you sort of have to be responsible for both.
Yeah, maybe it's Andy Warhol's fault, right? Because he said, you know, business is the best art. And he sort of merged, you know, when he set up the factory, it wasn't a studio, it was called the factory.
Right.
So, and he did turn the artist from this sort of starving creature in a garret into a bold-faced celebrity name. He changed the rules of the game, I think, for better or worse. I think for better. Oh, it's more interesting.
I think it's more interesting, yes, for sure. So I'm going to shift a little bit because I want to talk about Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, which is your new documentary on HBO. So you've sort of always been attached to provocative documentaries. So was Robert Mapplethorpe a subject who was already of interest to you, or were you approached specifically to do a project about Robert Mapplethorpe?
Well, Randy and I in the East Village in the 80s, we certainly knew who he was. Mm-hmm. You know, he was this singular brand name, Mapplethorpe. You know, it's funny, actually. We knew the name, really, before we knew the work. And then, of course, in the 90s, with the scandal after he died and the whole fuss, we knew all about that, too. But we weren't really drawn to him until Sheila Nevins at HBO said, oh, you guys should look at Mapplethorpe. And what we didn't realize was that there was going to be these two huge retrospectives at LACMA and Getty.
Which I was going to ask you about, is that just a coincidence that those two... That it's sort of one of the first, it's sort of unprecedented that there are sister shows, right? One at LACMA, one at the Getty, happening at the exact same time.
Right. I mean, that's because of that. The reason that happened is because before he died, Mapplethorpe set up this foundation to continue his work. And the foundation entrusted LACMA and the Getty together jointly with this vast amount of material of his. So for the first time, these two museums got together and decided to put on twin retrospectives. And that's great because it matches the way he, during his career, would often have the sex pictures in a downtown gallery and flowers or celebrity portraits uptown. He often had two shows at once. And that sort of definitely fits his sort of dualistic approach to everything.
Well, there's a great part in the movie where it actually showed the two invitations to the two different shows and how he, you know, courted one audience for one and one audience for the other.
Right, one is in a nice, like, it's his hand in a nice shirt, collar, cuff, you know, jacket thing, and then the other's in a leather, fingerless glove.
So the movie coming out at this time was just a coincidence, or was that just a smart move on HBO's part?
Well, we started researching and looking into it, and that's when we discovered that there's going to be these big retrospectives, and we were like, oh my gosh, we have to get this film finished in time for that. So it's all part of one big thing. So,
what was your opinion of Robert Mapplethorpe as an artist prior to your involvement?
I think it was more sort of ignorance, really. I didn't really know. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Photography really has become recognized as a fine art. And there's no question that back in the 80s, when Mapplethorpe was doing his work, it really wasn't. And I can just about remember this. It really wasn't seen as, you know, painting. That was real art. Photography, not so much. And I suppose that snobbery kept him off the radar. But he was so insistent that it was art. I mean, he was really instrumental in contemporary photography being recognized as a fine art, in addition to all the brilliant work he made. So, answer your question, we weren't really aware of him. We weren't really aware of his genius or his talent, to tell you the truth.
So that said, how long did the research... how long did it take to make the movie overall? And then how long was the research process? And how much of that did you and Randy do yourselves? And how much of it did you depend on people to pull for you?
Well, overall, it was about 2.5 years from start to finish.
Okay.
And then the research part, you kind of have to do it yourself. I mean, Mona Card, who's worked with us for many years, is fantastic at finding archive and digging people up and stuff. But you kind of have to get in there and get your hands dirty.
I feel like the last name Card is a perfect name for someone who researches.
Yeah, I guess so. But she's very, very good at it. She knows the stuff. And she, and then of course, what was great was that LACMA and Getty were doing their exhibitions, so they were also doing a huge amount of research that they were very generous about giving us access to. So it was a combination of things.
Now, Patti Smith, okay, she had been an early lover of Robert Mapplethorpe's, and she does not appear in the film aside from some still photographs, and I believe there are some sound bites from previous interviews.
Yeah.
Did she decline to participate?
She did, yeah. I mean, we asked her, obviously, not once and not twice, you know, but many times. And she never really...
Which is so interesting to me because she had a book just come out. Like, I would think that the timing would have been great for her.
I know, and she didn't really ever explain why. But weirdly, I do think sometimes, you know, strange things happen that actually you think that work to your advantage because... Look, you know, she'd written Just Kids, and it's a great book. We read the book, obviously. Right. But it's a chapter in her life, and it details this childlike, almost childlike romance. It's a sort of beautiful romance, and she tells the story beautifully. But it is just a chapter in Robert's life, and something of an anomaly, really, because he wasn't known for his heterosexual love affairs with women, you know, or maybe a couple of others.
Certainly not the way I am.
Exactly. So she turned him gay. No, I didn't say that. No, I think Robert was
It doesn't harm the movie in any way.
He was always gay, I think. And yeah. I think Patty's in the film to the extent she was in his life.
And the extent that she needs
to be. And what? Had we interviewed her, I think we would have felt obliged to put the interview all the way through. And the thing is, she's already told the story, her version of the story. And this film is Robert's story in Robert's own words, really. I mean, it is his voice that you hear the most, more than anyone else in the film.
Right.
And I think a lot of people have had a lot to say about Robert Mapplethorpe over the years. But the one person we haven't really heard from is Robert Mapplethorpe. And here he is in this film. And it's great. So in a way, thank you, Patty.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Thanks. So the movie opens in 1989 with the Republican senator. We were talking earlier about Jesse Helms holding up the Mapplethorpe photos for the U.S. Senate. And he's saying, look at the pictures. And he was upset that government funds from the National Endowment for the Arts were being used to help exhibit Mapplethorpe's work because he considered them pornography. So what made that the right jumping off point for the film? And did you know that was going to be the jumping off point?
Yes, we knew that was the jumping off point because that's how everybody knows about Robert Mapplethorpe. You know, many people don't know anything more about Robert Mapplethorpe than he took that photo and it was torn up and denounced. So that was our way in. We didn't know that it was the title of the film until we'd almost finished. We were like, what are we going to call this film? You know, and with The Eyes of Tammy Faye, we knew that title before we even started filming. You know, that was the film. And with this, we just didn't know what the title was. And it was staring us in the face the whole time. It's look at the pictures.
Right.
Because that's kind of what we do in the film. We just look at the
that's
pictures.
That's what it's about. It's an analysis to a degree.
Yeah.
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 So a few times in the movie, his sort of Mapplethorpe's technical savvy is sort of called into question. So it was seemingly like that part of his technique was sort of eclipsed by his desire for fame, or at least that's what I walked away with from having seen the movie. What are your thoughts on how it sort of applies to today's like attention-hungry culture? Because he was, again, maybe ahead of his time in that too.
Oh, yeah. He was definitely prescient, I think. And he was definitely a pioneer. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that it's understood that his desire for fame wasn't a self-contained desire for fame for his ego. It was purely to leverage his art for the work to be noticed and recognized. I don't think he was that interested in fame as an end in itself. It was all in service of the art. So I think maybe that's a slight difference to today, where you could say that some people want to be famous for famous' sake. But at the same time, Mapplethorpe was also, and this perplexed us, he'd said something in an interview early on in his career that he said something like, why can't it be the life one is leading that is the art? And then he said, you know, the pictures are less important than the life I'm leading. In other words, he was saying that his life was the work of art. And that was such a bold, odd idea.
Well, to a degree, it makes that point because it is a kind of self-involved point of view.
Yes. But I think he is the work of art, actually.
But by that logic, what makes your life or my life or anybody's life not a work of art?
Well, I believe all our lives are works of art. No, I do. And I think
when will my documentary be coming out?
You're an artist. Look at you, girl.
Totally
porn
kidding.
Again.
Totally
you've got
kidding.
It going on. So I think, you know, the pictures were documenting his life. Porn again documents your life.
Right.
And I think that's it's a really neat idea because I think it's very inspiring and very open to people can take it how they want.
How they want, right.
But I definitely think I can now see, whereas I might not have seen it before, a connection, say, between Mapplethorpe and the Kardashians. Their lives are works of art. And in fact, just for the sake of argument, I'd go further.
I think their surgeons agree with you.
Yes. But they do have a sculptural quality and they are working in a medium like Mapplethorpe that at the time was not considered artistic or worthy. I think in future we will look back and we will recognize, I know it sounds crazy to say it, But I do think we'll recognize.
No, I definitely think there's something to that. And yeah. I don't think that's without. I think that's for sure. Now, every documentary has some bias to it, right? Mm. Because by the nature of the fact that humans are involved with the editing, the sound, the direction. So in what ways would you say that you and Randy sort of painted your own picture?
Oh, totally. I mean,
in
Lord.
What ways would you say it's yours? Okay. It's yours.
Well, you know, telling a story is an act of bias.
Right.
You know, it just is because you're editing, you're taking raw reality and changing it. And so you're compressing it for one thing. You're leaving things out for another.
Right.
So in what ways? I mean, I think we looked at what we tried to do was say, every step away, we tried to say, well, what would Mapplethorpe do here? And once we had locked in on this idea of using his words, we used him as a sort of guide. I mean, you know, it was crazy, as a sort of spirit guide, I suppose, you know. So we tried to absent ourselves and let him do the talking and let him kind of tell us what to do. I'm sure, though, we did impose ourselves on it in some way, shape, or form. And I know you're looking at me now like saying, well, what? Tell me
that's
what?
Exactly
what ways? Stop flanneling.
It's so hard to figure out what my next question
flanneling.
Is
flanneling. What ways? What ways do you think? I mean, one thing is Randy and I are a partnership and there's two of us. And I think that's odd and interesting because not many films are directed by two people. And Mapplethorpe himself was very much into all sorts of dualism and he was a collaborator. So it's strangely apt that this documentary about his life would be directed by two people rather than one.
And were there ever moments where you and Randy disagreed on...
Oh, God, all the time. Are you kidding? We argue like cats and dogs.
So what would you say the biggest argument...
I'll tell you one thing before I get to the arguments.
Yeah, I'm getting right for the dish and you're trying to keep it all upscale.
No, I just finally thought of an example. Like, we decided to focus on the sex pictures. You know, he didn't take a lot of them and he didn't take them over a long period of time. It was a relatively short period. But the reason was Mapplethorpe himself said they're the most important pictures I've taken. So it seemed to us appropriate to give them pride
that attention.
Of place
yeah,
in
agree.
The film.
Right.
And so the ex portfolio, for example, mm-hmm. when we go through the ex portfolio, we look at every single picture. In the ex portfolio, mm-hmm. one after the other. It's one of my favorite sequences in the film.
I'm going to be getting to that in
it occurs
further details.
Right in the middle of the film. So the sort of X marks the middle of the film, which is just a neat
That's actually
thing.
Really interesting.
Yeah, right?
That's sort of like how Disney, all the Disney parks put the castle at the center.
There you go.
They're at a certain point in the park.
Right.
I see what you did there.
What did Randy and I argue about? I think we did go back and forth about the number of penises in the film. Like there was
who wanted more?
I think Randy wanted less. I think Randy wanted less.
And what was his reasoning behind wanting to keep
his reason was that there were too many.
Is there such a thing?
And I think it's understand there is a sort of, you know, what if they had that, what's that expression? Snow blindness, you know?
Yes.
I guess penis blindness. Like you suddenly.
Like maybe you become so desensitized
yes.
to it after you've seen a certain number.
Our German
because that
producer,
hasn't happened to me in 40 years. So I don't know where Randy's coming from.
Got something to look forward to. Our German producer saw it, the first cut she saw. She said, oh, it's like, I can't do her German accent, but it was fabulous because she said, it's like a penis buffet. And like, just sort of gagging on too many penises. And so we did go back and forth and put some in and take some out. And we actually agreed to put more in ultimately because we thought there's no way HBO is going to just show this as is.
So you figured if you sort of stacked it.
Yes, we could trade
you would
some
be able
out.
To take some
yes.
out. So it's a negotiating tactic.
Yes.
Penis as a negotiating
pulses
tactic.
Pulses for courses or penises for
I love it.
Pulses.
And I think we might have just coined a new term of penis blindness.
Penis blindness, yes. And I agree with you. I mean, everyone is different, I suppose. You can't see. I mean, Bob Colicello in Vanity Fair wondered if, you know, what we were trying to say by the fourth time we showed the picture of the whip up the butt.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting it.
But I think it's such an important portrait. And every time you see it in the film, and yes, you do see it more than once, it's serving a different purpose. And you reveals something different.
Well, like, and also it's different people reacting to it in different ways.
Yeah.
I think it's important to hear those people's perspectives about right. what you're seeing. And I think you have to remind the audience. I mean, to me, you know, I love documentary films. I'm not a critic, but I remember seeing you after the screening and saying to you, which is still what I think, is that there isn't a beat of that movie that's off. I mean, every moment of that movie, like the way the sound bites are cut, the way it all works perfectly. And you can tell that from the audience's reaction when you're watching it, which is why I'm glad I got to see it with people and not just on, not, no offense, I love watching them on HBO, but it was an extra treat to be able to see it with people and see that other people were responding the same way. So I think it's important to show it and get people, but what do I know? I'm not a documentary filmmaker.
Keep going. I'm loving this. I'm loving it. It's also nice to see it, though, on a big screen, too, you know.
Well,
size matters, right?
There you go.
I mean, that was a discovery because we didn't, when we saw the actual pictures, we were like, oh gosh, they're kind of small. And again, you know, we're so used today to art photography being huge pictures. They couldn't make them that big in those days.
Right.
Amazing. I mean, you forget these things. So.
But that's, I think that's part of the art is the time.
Yeah.
The time that it comes from. Now you chose to tell the story chronologically. Was there ever a consideration to not telling it in a traditional chronological way? And I was just curious as to the choice to do that, like telling the story from a different order. Like, why does that approach work best for this subject?
It is about the subject. Right. I mean, one is Mapplethorpe himself as an artist was actually, I was going to say, very conservative in the sense that he believed in classicism and form and he was very traditional. So telling the story backwards or chopping it up like Tarantino just didn't feel the right thing to do. And the other thing was, and I guess this is an extension of that, is that what he shot and the subject matter sometimes was so shocking, we thought, let's just make this completely traditional. Let's start off with a nice sequence about his childhood, lull the audience into feeling, oh, this is just a perfectly pleasant PBS documentary. And so by the time you get to the export folio, you're not freaked out. You're just sort of lulled into it.
You've been sort of like dipped in.
You're slowly. Like the egg in the saucepan of water and it's gradually coming to the boil and you don't notice. Oh, okay, here we go. And I think that's why people can watch it without having a violent reaction. And because it is, people do feel... people don't really comment on the explicitness of the film a lot. They do in retrospect, like, I can't believe it, but they don't feel they've been violated or shocked.
I didn't feel that way, but it takes a lot. I mean, I don't know what you'd have to do in front of me to feel violated. but I'm still waiting for somebody to violate me in some way.
You've got something to look forward to.
So when you conducted the interviews, because... Mapplethorpe, for example, his sister, his brother, you know, there are past lovers in it. When you conducted some of them, I assume Randy conducted some of them. Did you edit in your head at all? Like as you were talking to these people, did you think to yourself as you were there, oh, I know I'm going to go back to this bite, or I know I'm going to go back to that bite? Or were you basically a collector who then went through and looked at everything?
No, it's like, you know it when you hear it, you know what I mean? Like when Edward gives the final lines of the film, it was like chills. Because even then, it was like, that's it. Those are the last words in the film. No question, you know.
That's so fascinating to sort of be able to do it as you're going.
Yeah.
To a degree.
Yeah. I mean, other bits you don't know. And then there are always things you discover like, really? They said that? That's amazing.
Well, tonally, how did you decide to include certain sound bites? Because there are moments that are really like on a humorous note, then there are others that are much more melancholy, and then there are some that are really dark. So getting the pitch right for 2 whole hours, which you accomplish.
Oh, I love talking to you. It's so nice.
But it's true, because I wouldn't say it. If people know, I'll say what I think. So to get the pitch right of an entire 2-hour running time that you don't at one moment look at your watch or think that you're, you know, that you're watching some instructional video. So how did you, with those sound bites, like how did you accomplish that?
Well, you know, Randy and I have a thing of like, the story will tell you how to tell it. I know it sounds a little weird, but with Mapplethorpe, he said there was a sense of humor in his work. And so and the idea was that he, at the same time as being humorous, he expected people to take him seriously as an artist. So it wasn't like, I'm a comedian, I'm not an artist. It was like, I am a serious artist making serious art, and I'm also funny, and it is funny. And I suppose we just tried to honor that and replicate that in the film. So, and when you look at Man in Polyester Suit, it's a funny picture.
Right.
You know, so when Mapplethorpe says that art is about opening something up, it didn't seem too much editorializing to put that against, in the export folio, the guy with the dildo sticking it up his ass.
Right.
You know, literally opening himself up, but at the same time as Mapplethorpe's talking about art opening it up. I mean, it's a joke, it's funny,
right?
But it's also true, right?
Right. But then the moments that are a little darker.
Yeah.
How did you, I'm just wondering how you got the pitch right. Like how, like, because the movie is, it takes you on these little ups and downs.
Yeah, it is trial. I promise you, it doesn't work out the first time you sit in the edit bay. And Langdon, our editor, was just amazing. And it's trial and error, and you change it and you move things around. I mean, things were like being swapped and taken in and put in, taken out until the last moment. Because it is a balancing act.
As we used to say when I was at the studios, when it used to be in print, everything used to be prints. We used to say that print arrived at the theater wet. I forgot which movies it was. It was like when I was working on Armageddon, literally they got to the theater the day, like it, yeah. They were dripping with fluid, developing fluid.
Ooh, well, yeah, the film arrived at Sundance wet. Dripping.
That's what we used to say.
Yeah.
So in his early work, which this is in the movie, Mapplethorpe would make collages using images from gay porn magazines. And he shot photos for some of those, you know, the old gay magazines. So in your opinion, what separates those kinds of pictures, the pictures that he was taking for, you know, what jerk-off material, what separates that from what became the ex-portfolio art?
You're right. And I mean, I suppose the only difference was his say-so. Like, later in his life, he would shoot one day flowers and the next day a portrait and the next day a sex picture. And he was also shooting for, and this was really surprising, for a heterosexual, hardcore porn magazine. He did shoots for them. And I was like, why? Why? But I think
I guess the angles, you know, the angles at a certain point, who cares what's going into what hole, you know how to shoot the angle.
So he was good at it, in other words. Right. But I mean, he was happy, I think, doing art some days and doing, I suppose he went high some days and low other days.
Right.
I mean, he definitely believed in that high-low divide. He definitely believed in art, in a canon of art, and expected his work to be in that canon, you know?
So then, not to put thoughts in his head, though, yeah, but do you think he saw the work that he was doing for those magazines to be beneath the work that he was doing for galleries?
Well, I think he just knew it was different. And so he did commercial work. I mean, he wanted to do more commercial work than he did. So, and he knew that was advertising, print advertising. And I don't think he tried to pass that off as art. I think he accepted the divisions as they existed. I mean, I think some of his advertising work is fantastic, you know?
No, I mean, I don't have an opinion on it per se. I just look at it and I'm like, well, what really separates, you know, one from the other?
Well, I think if you look at the export folio, it's so self-evident. A work of art. And I think what's interesting about it is that it is a portfolio, you know, rather than a picture in a frame on a wall, it's this box of 13 pictures. Mm-hmm. And none of us really knew that in between each picture was a red, vivid red sheet. That was him. And I think that completely, that's a whole added element, because you're looking at these black and white pictures and then you get this shock of just red.
Well, and that's true. I mean, presentation is a lot of it.
So there you go. It's the presentation. It's the presentation and the packaging. And he sort of said, this is the art. It's like, you know, sometimes an artist will do an edition of prints, or sometimes they'll do a unique piece. It's like each one is different, a different, slightly different market, slightly different result.
So as a filmmaker and somebody who's worked on a number of acclaimed movies, is it really ever finished? Like when you look at, when you see it at other screenings, do you think, oh, like I would take that shot out, or I would fix this? I mean, I do that even when I have to reread something from my book. I'm like, oh, I would take that page out, or I'd word it differently, you know. And my editor used to say at a certain point, she'd be like, enough, like it's done. You know, you've got to move on.
It's never finished.
Right.
But, and it's never finished. And you know what? It never plays the same way twice. So it's truly a different experience every time because of the audience. Sometimes they'll laugh a lot more. Sometimes they'll be like silent, or sometimes they'll gasp. It's truly a different experience every time. And then there's the DVD extras. So you can like put in some of the stuff you had to take out.
So what are we going to get on the DVD? Well, can you give us a hint?
Yeah. There's a sequence. There's a whole bunch of sequences where he shoots people. There's Lydia Chang, who was another bodybuilder model of his, who he only ever really shot as a torso, and she talks about that experience. There's the last portrait he ever took was of the Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, who was a hero. You know, he did everything he could about AIDS at a time when the government was denying it. And the poignancy of the whole thing is that Mapplethorpe always wanted to be on the cover of Time. And he was dying, and he got this commission to shoot Everett Koop. So he got into Time, but it wasn't the way he wanted to. But he shot Everett Koop because he was the Surgeon General. And as Jack Walls, his boyfriend of the time, explains, maybe he would know something about how to fight this disease, how to survive. Maybe he could tell Robert something. And it was the sequence was in, and then it was out, and then it was in, and it was out. And it's one of those things that down to the last minute, you don't know whether to put it in or take it out.
Well, so how do you feel, like how precious about the material are you as a filmmaker? Do you, with now with DVD and Blu-ray, there's all this opportunity for bonus material and added value. Do you feel like the movie's the movie and this is what it is and it's locked, and if we wanted that in there, it would have been in there? Or are you comfortable with...
Oh, I'm fine sticking it on a DVD as an extra. I think Randy and I like that because it just sometimes like lets you show a little bit more of your process and also give a bit more just value, I think, you know, just a bit more insight. But ultimately, the choices we made, the film is the film, you know, that's locked. But the extras, I think it's okay to put them in as little extras somewhere else. I mean, the C. Everett Koop thing, we really wanted it in the film, but it just stopped the film dead in its tracks. There's another great moment where Nancy, his sister, goes to visit Robert. She's never seen a loft before. She goes to visit Robert in his loft, and Robert has to get himself all dressed up, takes the parents. He's showing his parents, look at all I've achieved, look at all his stuff, it's spectacular. And Nancy takes him, she wanted to get him something, and she takes him a snow globe, like a cheap sort of snow globe of a church in the snow. And all afternoon he sat there turning the snow globe up and down, up and down. It's like, it's just great. And you could say, well, why isn't that in there? It just stopped the story, just where you are in the storytelling process. Sometimes you have to...
So in a way, you had to make creative sacrifices,
you do,
and then this gives you an opportunity
just to like say, here, take a look at this.
So now that the show is available on HBO and reviews have come out, and they were overwhelmingly rave reviews, how does that feel, having invested so much time, having invested 2.5 years in this, and to be rewarded that way?
It feels nice, right?
Well, I mean, it's certainly better than the alternative.
Yes, but we've experienced the alternative where it's like you can't find a review that has anything nice to say. You know,
well,
that kind of sucks. I mean, but it's the journey, right?
Right.
It is the journey. And it's really nice that people, you know, there's something about Mapplethorpe that people are, he is just enduringly fascinating.
Right. But I'm saying in terms of the filmmaking work, because you can have a fascinating subject, you know, just like you can have a great actress in a shitty movie. You know, they win awards all the time.
Right.
So here you took a subject, yes, that's fascinating, but in other hands may not have been a compelling 2-hour documentary. So here you invested 2 years and you made all of these choices and you had the arguments with Randy and the things that we talked about before about what would be in, what wouldn't be in. And clearly you made the right choices because across the board, people have thought that this was a well-told story. So does that, would you have felt, regardless of what the reviews have been, would you have felt that you had done the subject proud either way?
Well, yes, if I was a pure person, yes, I should feel that way. I should feel that.
But there is a validation that comes from
reviews,
right?
There is, you know. And it
gets worse. That's what I'm trying to get you to say.
It gets worse all the time, you know, with Facebook, you know. Because I think that this has been a different experience to our other films, just because there's Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. And in 2004 with Inside Deep Throat, I can't remember, I know Facebook existed.
Well, yes, barely.
Barely.
Right? I mean, the social media was not. It wasn't.
Right? So there's all these ways.
But now everybody has a platform. It's like everybody has an opinion about everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll send you, I mean, I'm sure you've gotten the same kind. I mean,
I kind of read them all.
You do read them all?
I do. I do. I mean, I know people say you should ignore.
How do you react to the bad ones?
Like, terribly, do they upset you? I go into, yes, it does. I'm very thin-skinned.
Don't read the comments.
I know. And
I had to learn that.
On Million Dollar Listings and a lot of our shows, we're always telling people in front of the camera, don't read what they say in social media.
Right.
It's easier to say than to do.
Of course. You know? And you know, I think we all forget, and I have learned in my experiences that, you know, sometimes I walk out of a movie or I see a TV show and I didn't love it. And, you know, our first reaction is to let people know we didn't like something now.
Right.
And I stop myself to some degree because that's somebody else's creative output.
Right.
And whether somebody likes something I've done or not, I'm a human and it feels bad when somebody doesn't. So why, you know, if I didn't like it, I don't need to spend any more time considering it.
This is true. I mean, I feel bad about, you know, over the years, I've had many things to say about Madonna. Oh, I like the single. Oh, I hate the single. Oh, I don't like this interview. And I feel, gee, you know, she's a person too.
Well, but I'm not sure in that case. She's a little more of a robot.
She's also public. Well, she's robot or not, she's a public entity.
Well, and
she
does things to provoke the love-hate. I mean, she does that. I mean, she's all about, you know, it's sort of like there are a lot of media personalities and you look at them and their whole gig is about people who love them and hate them. And if everybody loved, then that you, like I say that a lot of times about Nancy Grace, you know, if everybody loved what Nancy was doing, the game would be up.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that it's a conflict. It's a debate. It's pushing a button. And I think that's sort of what Madonna does. I think to some degree, she throws it out there and she likes the talk. She likes the,
Well, as Oscar Wilde might've said, there's only one thing worse than being talked about.
And that's not being talked about. So I say you go ahead and you say whatever you want about Madonna and what she's doing. So my last question about the Mapplethorpe documentary, what has the response been from the people who appear in the film? I mean, obviously the critics loved it. The people who appear in the film, how do they feel? What has been the feedback? How do they feel about how they were represented, how his life was represented? I mean, they're the ultimate critics, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think they liked it. They felt that the film captured the complexities of him. And I'm always surprised when people say, oh, you know, I liked the film, but I didn't like him. Because I think he was likable, but not necessarily in a traditional way. And I think his friends and lovers reveal that in the film. You know, in a way he transcended likability, but they loved him. And I think hopefully that comes across. It is a little contradictory seeming, but I think that was he's very complex. And I think they felt that it is a bit of a responsibility to tell someone's life and use other people to help you tell the story of that life. It's it's you just want to make sure you get it as right as you can. And the truth is, I think you can't get it right completely. You're always going to make some kind of mistake. And I think Maple thought, if he saw the film, he might say, well, it's almost good. You know, and that would be great.
I would say I would take that as a rave from him.
Yeah.
So Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, is available now on HBO, so people can watch that on demand. And then obviously a DVD and Blu-ray will be coming out.
Yeah.
We probably don't know a date yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully we get it into more theaters over the coming months.
Well, and also, I mean, in my opinion, it should qualify for awards. So hopefully that'll be the, you better get that campaign started.
That would be very nice. That would be nice.
So during the show, I usually take a sex or dating question from my Gay Times column, or have people that write in from my Huffington Post stories, things that I couldn't get to in print.
Right.
So we hear from Parker in Miami, who sent me a private message on Facebook because he and his boyfriend have a huge sex drive disparity. So Parker likes to have sex at least once a day. His partner's fine with once or twice a week. So they're completely in love with each other, but they're trying to figure out how to deal with the differences in their sex drives before it ruins a good thing. So he's asking if that's fixable. So
What are you telling him?
You know, I think it is fixable. I think that, you know, I think all relationships are about compromise. And, you know, just as much as who's going to take the garbage out, how and what you do in the bedroom can be just as much of a compromise. So I think both people have to meet in the middle. So if one person wants it every day and one person wants it once a week, you figure out how to do it two or three times a week.
Good answer. That's my answer. Yeah.
I think if both people dig their heels in, then it's going to combust.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're right.
You're married and...
I'm married, you know. But like, you know, the longer you are together, you have to make compromises. Otherwise, you're going to split apart.
Right.
And in theory, in some ways, it gets easier because you've made prior compromises and you know each other better. But then occasionally it's harder because you're like, I've compromised on this, and I'm not.
Right, you sort of know the list. Right.
So, but I think ultimately.
Because I don't think it has to break up. I don't think this has to break up a relationship.
Well, you know, sooner or later, they're probably not going to, like 10 years from now, you know.
They won't be having sex
maybe
anyway.
It'll level off. Yes, exactly. Or
it'll all end by then.
Be lucky if they are. Right. But it doesn't need to end, you know. Like, compatibility is more than how many times you fuck a day.
Well, no, I agree. But there are some people who are very steadfast. Just like, you know, one of the things I've discussed in the column before is people who feel that they're, you know, their sexual roles, like, you know, top versus bottom, and they won't date somebody who right off the bat, they want to know if that person's, quote, compatible. They won't get to know somebody based on that. And I say, again, it's about compromise. And if you really respond to somebody, and it's hard enough to find those people who we respond to, to then cut that dating pool in half seems a shame to me.
Yeah.
So I always think there are ways to make things work, is sort of my opinion.
And if you're going to be with someone forever, you know, in that long-term sense, I just don't think the top or the bottomness or the amount of sex, like, it just...
I agree.
That is not what's going to keep you together.
I agree. It becomes bigger than that, as it were.
Mutual compatibility.
So that is...
Sorted that out.
Look how quickly we did that. Solved everyone.
And we agreed.
Solved the world problems. The world's problems. So thank you to Fent Bailey for joining us. You can find him on Twitter at FJ Bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y, and Instagram at Fenton J Bailey. And you can follow World of Wonder at World of Wonder on Twitter and Wow Report on Instagram. Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures is in theaters, select theaters now, and available on HBO. And don't forget RuPaul's Drag Con, May 7th and 8th, 2016 at the Los Angeles Convention Center. And be on the lookout for some new episodes coming soon. Thank you, Fenton.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thanks for listening. The No Holds Barred conversation continues 24/7 on Facebook at Josh Sabara Author and Twitter and Instagram at Josh Sabara.
and then buckle your seatbelts for some titillating real talk. Porn Again, a memoir by Josh Sabara, is available now as a trade paperback, ebook, and audiobook.